This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Hello, hello, hello. This is Clint Locklear from Trappin' Radio, and we have got a pretty interesting show tonight. We're definitely going to give you something you've never heard before as far as a fur report, and this is what a real fur report should be like. It's what stuff's selling for. There's no marketing, there's no agenda, there's no anything. This is what people are actually selling fur, and the guy that's going to be doing that, he's been on here several times, is Jeff Dunlap. Lives up in Alpena. And what you may not know about Jeff is he really pays attention to a lot of things. He's been in this business pretty much his whole life, going all the way back with his dad. So, you know, he doesn't fall for the bamboozlement as much, and he's just being very realistic. So instead of trying to tell people what stuff is going to be, hopefully or not, well, I thought what we would do when people are having auctions, we can you know, explain exactly what stuff's really selling for in the real world and not in some type of propaganda type way of going about it. So you're going to hear that. Now, there's two things I want to talk about before we get to the fur report. Is I just got off the phone with a gentleman that was otter trapping, and he had a female beaver, and something ate out its belly and covered it with leaves. And the question was, is that an otter or is that a bobcat? Guys, since that just happened like 30 seconds ago with a phone call, if you're ever in doubt what's happening on your line, if something in a bobcat will actually get in the water and pull out a beaver. So, you know, I've definitely seen that happen several times. So just because they're in the water doesn't mean they're safe from a bobcat. Because I can tell you, when I come in from making cat collector, we've got about, I don't know, it's probably about 8-month-old kitten. And he gets so excited when I come in with cat collector to take a shower so I don't smell like that so much. He will actually get in the shower with me. So if a cat has something they want to get close to, they're going to do it, and water's not going to hurt them. So if you've got a beaver or a nutria or something like that, and it's pulled up on the bank and it's just eaten, most of the time that could be a cow or a house dog or whatever. But if it's covered up, for the most part, it's going to be a bobcat. Now, what that means to you, the trapper, is you've got almost, unless you do something kind of crazy, you almost got a guaranteed cat the very next night, because the cat's going to come back. Now, you can put it in a cubby. You can put, just blind set traps around it. Whatever you think's best for you to do, but you've got a guaranteed cat if that happens. So if that happens on your beaver line, instead of getting mad, just look at your having a pretty cool way to catch a cat, you know, because he's telling you he's there. We used to do this in Louisiana a lot. When I was doing it for the bounty, I would, if there was any damage whatsoever to the beaver, or beaver didn't look good or whatever, I'd cut the castor out and the oil sacks and the tail off for the bounty, and I would throw it up on the bank next to a big tree or some type of structure, and every day I would come by and look at the cat. As soon as it was covered up, set traps, catch cat. I mean, it really works about that way. So, if you're ever wondering, guys, yes, it is a bobcat. Now, this is a strange thing. You want to know, when I say that I love America, and I always want to put the caveat, I love America, not the American government. You know, they're two separate, different things. But if you've ever wondered, and if you're in college right now, and you ask a professor, the professor probably won't agree with this, but something happened to me a couple of days ago coming out of the post office that proves to me why America is really the most ingenuitive type society in the world. Like China, Japan, Vietnam, they're very good at copying, they're very good at manufacturing, they're very good at, you know, figuring out how something works if it's already an idea. Now, most countries, even in Europe, they have a hard time, because you can look at the patents that's world held, and you'll see America has got almost all of them. That's just our culture, and that's what makes us so powerful in the world, is you can come up with something and you can do it. So that's one of the things I absolutely love about what happened to me the other day. So I'm coming out of the post office. I've got Hilltop's neck knife on that you've probably seen on YouTube, or you can go check it out. It's actually made out of a trap spring, hand forged. I use it every day. I hate to say how bad I abuse this thing, because it's opening boxes for the lure and popping off, you know, stuff on essential oils. And if I'm, you know, planting trees, I'm cutting through the roots if it's getting root ball, and I'm, you know, going and opening the heavy bags on the duck feed with it. I mean, it just gets abused. But anyway, I'm coming out of the post office, and this older guy looked to be somewhere around, if I was guessing, 56, 57, maybe 60, probably not. And he just looked like he could have been a farmer, you know, or someone that works on farm equipment or something like that, just kind of the impression, you can tell this dude worked with his hands, and he's done it for a long time, the way he was built and everything. And I'm walking past him, not thinking anything about it, and he goes, "Hey, man, that's a cool knife." I go, "Thank you." He goes, "What is that?" And I pulled out and showed it to him. I said, "Well, this is actually a spring off an old long spring trap. These are the hole. This is the hole that the jaws went through, and they had to flatten it out, hand forge it, and sharpen it and all that." He goes, "Where'd you get it from?" And I said, "Hilltop." And then he said, "You know, I make knives too." Now, see, was the two things I loved about what happened is an entrepreneur that makes knives saw an opportunity with a customer that had somewhat of a custom knife. And he went about talking to me about it where it didn't come across as a sales pitch. Awesome. Awesome job. And then we get to talking, and, you know, you hand forge knives. Yeah, you know, what kind of knives do you make? Well, I make, you know, neck knives, and I make pocket knives, and I make sheath knives, and I make battle axes and short swords and spears. And when he said spears, it just took me off balance, to be honest with you. And I was like, "Spear?" And he goes, "Spear." And then, you know, my octave probably went up again, like, "Spear?" And he goes, "Yeah, make a spear. It's a walking stick." Well, so now he's pulled me into his story, which is a great lesson, guys, if you ever want to be an entrepreneur. But now he's drawn me in. And I'm like, "What do you mean it's a spear that's a walking stick?" He said, "Well, for people that don't carry conceal, the state parks in Tennessee have a law," which they do, "where you cannot carry a knife that has over an 8-inch blade." And, you know, that just perturbs people when the state, you know, says you can go to jail or get a big fine if you've got a 9-inch blade. Now, going into a state park, unless you're going to camp or something like that, I'm not sure what you'd need that big a blade for, but that's what happened. So, this guy that looked like he could have been a farmer or works or welder or something like that, he saw an opportunity to have a product that fits a need for somebody that's worried about self-defense but does not want to carry a sidearm. And what he did is he did the American thing that is so freaking awesome, is he figured out a way to fix a problem with a solution that he can sell. Now, what it is that he's made, and I have not seen one yet, but as soon as one of these is done, he knows to call me, and I told him, if it looks good, I'm going to buy one. And just as much because I think it's a cool idea, someone that is going to come up with something that you can carry a freaking spear into a state park, but you can't carry a 9-inch bladed knife, I just love that attitude. I just love that attitude. I'm going to support him just for that. Now, these are not cheap. This is probably going to be about $250 is what he said, depending on how decorative I want it, which mine won't be that decorative. But what it is a staff that's made out of hickory or oak or something like that. He said sometimes he uses cherry if he finds some really good center wood. And he makes it where it's like a walking stick. So it's about 6 foot high. It's got a lanyard on it. You can do decorations and burning and all that type stuff. But you go down towards the bottom, and you'll see that there's a little brass flare, and the bottom of the walking stick comes out where it looks kind of like, how can I describe it? I think it's a spade on cards. So it comes down, and it flares out on both sides and comes down like a point, like a heart. That is 8 inches long, and it's 8 inches wide, so it's completely in the parameters, and it's got a wooden sheath that goes on the end, and it's got a big rubber stopper on the bottom, so you go walking. And if you've ever been hiking, especially around Appalachia, a walking stick definitely makes things easier because you're going down rocks a lot, and stuff is slick, and everything else like that. And having a walking stick is very common to see. Maybe not one that's flared out on the bottom, but, you know, no one's going to think it's a spear. But how you activate the spear, to me, is ingenious. When you put, all you got to do is put your toe on the brass, which is coming up and meets the wood like a perfect glove from what he tells me. And you flip it off with your foot, and now you've got a 6-foot staff with an 8-inch razor blade, hand forged, tempered hard spear point. That is cool. Now, do I really need a spear? Probably not. But I've got a lot of things that I don't need. So I get to talking with him, and I'm going to have him redesign the spear point for me. And since he's a craftsman and hand forges himself, that's going to be able to do. I'm not worried about taking it on a state park, but I do think it would be a good idea for what I may try to use this on one day, is to have it maybe 3 inches wide and probably about 12 inches long and come and be like a dagger, is basically what mine's going to look like. But it's still going to be a walking stick. And it won't be as obvious what I'm doing. But the reason I'm doing it, because like when I was at Chip's with a meat trapper, I could have speared a hog very easily that came out of the brush. And it's a long story that I'm not going to get into, but all I had on me was a 38. And the hog was about 400 pounds. And I didn't trust the 38 plus P's jacketed hollow points that I carry in the 38. I just had it. I didn't have my rifle with me. We're just looking for drag marks. This thing came out on me. But I had the walking stick. I know I could have speared that bad boy. And there was another situation while we were down at Chip's, where if Chip would have had this, he could have speared a deer out the window of the truck. Now, if it's legal to spear out the window of a truck, I don't know in Mississippi, but it's just one of those things that I think would be kind of a cool way to actually try to hunt. And, you know, whatever. So I'm going to have mine designed a little bit different. So, because I'm worried about the 8 inches. Now, he built this for self-defense. Now, an 8-inch flared out pointed heart-shaped spearhead that's hand-forged and sharp is going to go through anything on a human being. Clothes, jackets, doesn't make any difference. And apparently he sold a ton of these, and kudos for him for that. So that is just one of the things that's happened to me this week that I think is really, really cool. A walking stick that is a spear to get around a stupid law that doesn't make any sense or any reason whatsoever when you're on a state park. But now you've got something that's 10 times as deadly. And he actually was saying there's guys that bear hunt with these things. And if you stand back, you can throw it through 3/4-inch plywood. So, I mean, this is a serious weapon, all because of an entrepreneur took a little bit different approach. So I just thought that was cool, and I thought I'd share it with you. Now, here is the Trapper's unofficial official spy fur report.
Hi, my name is Jeff Dunlap, and this is Trapping Radio's Fur Report. This is our first show. You're in on the ground floor. I don't know exactly what that will, in the end, benefit you, but you are in on the ground floor. You got bragging rights now. So, anyways, what we're going to cover is NAFA sales, local sales, kind of give you a price structure. We're not going to be going back like a month or 2 months on prices and stuff. That would not help you in, you know, selling your fur in the next couple weeks, or see what's coming up to be able to push some of your furs for better prices and stuff. Basically, what we want to do is give you options, sell some of your fur and stuff. NAFA had a sale last week. As far as us being trappers, the only thing that they sold was coyotes, cats, and sable. Basically, I'm going to cover some of them prices, do a rundown on them, and then we'll talk about some local, like state sales and stuff like that. And one good positive point, what happened was we got two positives, one negative with a possible positive, and you'll figure that all out. The positive was they sold the coyotes what they had for 100% on all four categories, on heavy, semi, eastern, and section 3. And we're going to run down the prices. The average, remember, they sold all four categories that they sold 100%. So they didn't give them away. The heavies averaged 107.16. The semi heavies averaged 38.15. The easterns averaged 47.23. And the section 3, which is like, you know, the junk is a, like, it might have rubs, it could be blowed in half with a 30-30, you know, basically all the junk stuff would be the section three. And that averaged 15.35, which doesn't, you know, I mean, is that the best prices if you've been doing this your whole life that you've ever heard? Probably not. But you know what? I mean, that's pretty good. I mean, I'm ecstatic with it. And, you know, 100% sale. There's a market out there for the stuff. And advancing into the next sale, it's looking, like, really good. So I think everything's a positive, you know, as far as us being trappers and fur harvesters and stuff and selling this stuff. And the Martin, very strong sale for Canadian American Sable. The section, the XXLs / XLs heavies, 108.77, extra large, 105.35, large, 66.29, and overall average on the heavy was 89.93. That beats the heck out of coon prices, any way you want to look at it. The semi-heavy, the XXL / XL, 85.21. The extra large, 68.23. The large, 49.68. Overall average is 58.75. And if you put the heavies and the semis together, the average was 69.74. So, you know, I think selling 100%, you know, is that the most we've ever heard of? No. But, you know, it's way better than what everybody thought it was going to be in September on all this stuff. So, you know, be grateful. I'm grateful. And, now comes the negative with the positive. So the NAFA, what they do is a lot of times is they'll give you a report and they'll show like one part of it that sold good and they don't show you the rest, you know, where it fell apart. There was 2,627 cats put forth. All I have is the Western heavies, Western semis numbers. The Western heavy sold 88%. The average was 423.14. The Western semis, 60% sold, 225.16. They didn't sell 100%. You know, moved some cats, and we're anticipating they're going to be better. You know, the cat market later on will probably be better. But it's like the top price on the cats was $3,700. Now, for most of us, that doesn't mean anything. You hear gimmick and you hear all kinds of stuff on it. But you know what? When you're one of them 10 people, because 10 cats sold for $3,700 a piece. Not 10 cats for $3,700. $3,700 a piece. If you're one of them 10 people, you don't care if it's a gimmick or not. Just give me the money. We're going to Taco Bell, mama. You know? So, gimmick or not, $3,700. Congratulations. And if you're one of the guys that got that, or ladies that got that, or the kids that got that, that's awesome. I'm happy for you. I wish everybody out there was getting that, but I congratulate you on that. So, what the NAFA does say on the cat sale, all the buyers are anxiously waiting for the fresh collection in May, as demand for this luxurious article is very high. So basically, these are the cats left over from last year. All the new ones are going to be on the May sale, and they're just clawing, and I mean, they're just going crazy waiting, according to NAFA. One good thing I did see is where they said cats sold very well at advancing prices under strong competition, especially from Italian fashion industry, with good support from Greece, Russia, and Asia. So we got Russia back in it, which we all know is positive, and Asia's in it. So, you know, if they're bidding on cats, maybe they'll buy some coons. So, but as far as, like, say you're a newer person getting into this, what you got to think about is where to sell your stuff. and I'm not going to tell you where to sell it. You have to use your own common sense and good judgment and make money and lose money and everything. What, you know, marketing your stuff where you think you can get the most, and a lot of times you're wrong on it, or what sale to be on, and you know, nobody knows. You just take educated guesses and, you know, cross your fingers and say a prayer and you know, just do it. And but with NAFRA, if you want to have your stuff sent through them, I know here in Michigan, to be on this next May sale, which everybody is you know, thinking it's going to be awesome, at least big parts of it are, with the coyotes, the rats, which we'll get into and stuff. So if you want to be in on that, like in Michigan, our last pickup date for that in northern Michigan, I got to meet the NAFRA person in Alpena, Michigan on February 24th for that May sale. So you have to look on NAFRA's website. I can't run down all the lists. Just look on their website. It'll say pickup schedules or whatever. Click on that and you'll find your area. Okay, North American Fur Auction. The Fur Harvester stuff I don't have, so you'll have to look up that if you want it. As far as sales, I mean, you got different options. You got the NAFRA, you got Fur Harvesters, which, you know, are good and bad, just like everything in life. But you also got your state sales, which we're going to cover now, and then you got your local fur buyers who do a good job too. You know, so if you need the money right now, you know, it's best to go through your local fur buyer or the state sales, and a lot of times it's the local fur buyers are buying at the state sales. You know, not always, but you know, a lot of them do, at least here in Michigan. So what I'm going to do is we're going to go through some, as you know, from time restraints, there's no way to go through every single sale in the United States. But usually you can find on the Trapping Association, like Michigan Trappers, you can find in their forum, you know, what the sale prices were. You can find them on Ohio, you know, a lot of them. Indiana will have theirs up probably on Facebook at some point. You know, so like last week was Indiana sale and Ohio sale, and you know, you can find the results from them to see in, you know, upcoming sales if I don't, you know, announce them. At the Michigan sale, the last one they had was at Otisville, and the beaver averaged 1041, bobcats 3667, coyotes averaged 2061. Deer hides, man, they're really down this year. Looks like 519 for deer hides. Man, a couple years ago they were up to like $14. The guys were just making a killing. And I love it. Gray fox 1367. Red fox 1604. Female mink 433. Male mink, double the price, $829. The muskrats, there was 2,621 on that sale. They averaged 422. That's a put up rat. And one otter was there, $45. That seems to be about, man, what a heartbreaker on them otter the last couple of years at $15 and less. My God, is that horrible. I mean, that's almost like just stabbing yourself in the leg with a freaking knife, you know? I ain't selling the otter for $15. That Chinaman could go without the fur hat on his damn head. But I ain't giving him my otter for $15. Ain't no way in hell. So, that's my rant about that. It really irritates me, as you could tell. But they're up. I'm hearing 40, 45 in that neighborhood. You know, if you're selling to a local buyer, or, you know, it might be less. But, you know, that's generally what I'm hearing, $40, $45. And raccoons, the heartbreaker of the fur industry, average $450. And that's a put up, you know. So, I mean, that's you know, but like, you know, grease muskrats are averaging 318. So, I mean, when we started this in the year, I was going all over the United States, and I was seeing, you know, where, you know, the water was drying up. I figured rats were going to, population would be down, and, you know, they'd have to pay more for that buck and a half for them. And luckily I was right, because that's what I target a lot this year. But, you know, it kind of gives you an idea. You know, a lot of times you can sell caster there, squirrel tails. You know, that's to check what's legal in your area. But one thing you can do is, like I say, look on the website, look up sales. And, like in Michigan, they're going to have a sale in Michigan. I believe everybody can come there and sell. You just got to join Michigan in Kalamazoo, February 18th. There'll be a sale. The last Michigan sale, it's like a cleanup sale for beaver and otter, stuff like for spring trapping. Michigan sale, it'd be in Houghton Lake at Prudenville, April 15th, okay? And Indiana, they're going to be having one. You have to look it up on the Fur Taker site and or get a hold of somebody on Facebook. They can tell you, but I think it's Fur Takers 7B. They're going to be having another one in Indiana. Ohio, March 11th, Kid Ron, Ohio. New York, out to Genesee County, they're going to be having one this Sunday. So there's other ones around the country. If you ask on Facebook or look on the Trap Association's websites, you're going to find them. There's a lot of information out there, and you know, it's a good spot to sell. One thing I'll tell you as a closing note, what you want to do is when you're going to put your fur through the fur sales, when you call, you might have to get your lot number. Some want you to sign up there, some allow you to sign up there. But some will grade your fur, some won't grade your fur. You have to grade it yourself, which I prefer. But you want to give the buyers a good grade on that stuff, especially if you have a lot of fur, because what you're doing is you're moving it through. They're trying to move this sale through, especially if they have a lot of fur, and that buyer only has a second to look. And if you've got like extra large rats that's supposed to be, you know, your good rats, and he starts popping through them real quick, just flicking them like a deck of cards and looking, and he starts seeing holes in the belly damage and stuff that ain't supposed to be in there, he's not going to bid the top dollar on that, because he knows that there's junk in there. Okay, so give him a good grade. He's only got a second to look. It'll pay for you off for you in the end. Because, I mean, if you're standing up there buying and they go and they put some junk in there and you've seen it, you're not going to take your own money and bid on junk that you can't really, you know, go through like if you had the time. So you're going to get a lesser price. So don't give them nothing to look at that's junk in there. Keep it a straight grade. Give them something good to look at, and 9 out of 10 times you're going to come out better on the other end than trying to pull something. Don't try and pull nothing, because once you get that reputation with them buyers, they remember you year to year. You might slip through one year, but they're going to remember, and it's going to cost you money, and it ain't worth getting that reputation of, you know, trying to scam over the buyers. So anyways, that's it for this week. When we have more information, we'll pass it along.
Thanks, Jeff. If you don't know who he is, that's Big Daddy, the Death Dealer, Jeff Dunlap himself. He'll be at a lot of the conventions this summer. And if you like what he's doing, let him know. And I want to, while I was listening to that, you know, fur prices are down. You know, the cow prices are actually pretty good. And the rat prices, when you look at what some people are being sold at the auctions, you know, $5, $6, that ain't bad. I mean, for 20 years, I was having a hard time someone would pay over $2.20 for a muskrat. And I caught a bunch of them and sold them for that. But, you know, when you're looking at these prices and you got gray fox around 13 and, you know, beaver at this and coyotes at that, before you get too down on it's not making money, because, you know, I don't know if we've talked about this. I know we have on the business course, but, you know, Americans have a deficiency that I call the big lick syndrome. And they're always looking for the big lick. And if something's not a big lick, they overlook it. And by big lick, I mean, you can, you know, otters are 180. Bobcats are 400. You know, that's what they get excited about. But I just want to break this down. Let's say you catch 6 animals an hour, you know, when you're averaging out, and maybe not this year per se, but you're averaging coon and some gray fox and a couple of coyotes and an otter here and there. But all over, when you do all those animals together, you come up with, say, $15 a piece. So 15 times 6 is 90, and that's in an hour. So if you're really humping it and pushing it and you're in good areas and you've planned all this stuff out, you're talking $90 an hour. Now, some of you probably make $60, $90 an hour. Where I live, no, not going to happen at a job somewhere. So, and then you're going to go, well, that's not really $90 an hour. I got to put it up. Yes, you do. So let's take that 90 and divide it by half of what you're actually making. And now you're down to $45 an hour on $15 average animals if you can do six an hour. So, you know, that's not very unrealistic, you know, depending on where you're at and different things like that. It may be harder for some than others. But when you start talking about making $45 an hour on cheaper fur, dude, that's still rocking. I'm sorry. That's still rocking in most of America. Now, if you live in San Francisco or, you know, New York City, that's probably about minimum wage if you're going to live somewhere like that because everything's so expensive. But for most of us to listen to this show, $45 an hour, $30 an hour, you know, $35 an hour, that ain't bad money. It is really not bad money. So just keep that in mind when you hear these prices. And if you catch yourself going into the big lick syndrome, when you're only thinking about fur as being, it's just got to be so high where you can be a bad trapper and still make money, maybe you need to relook at how you're doing what you're doing to get that done. So that's just my thoughts that popped in my head when I was listening to Jeff, and I thank him very much for doing that. He's going to have some more coming up. Now, the main meat of the show today, guys, is going to be something that may seem very basic. And a lot of people have different ways that they go about it. So I'm going to go over how I do certain things, and I'm not saying my way is the only way or someone else's way is wrong or something like that. But we're going to talk about blocking. Now, we know blocking. How do you get an animal as best you can to put his foot where your trap is at? Blocking is a simple concept, but it's also one that if you just haphazardly do it, it doesn't do you very well and can actually hurt you. But there's a funny story. I watched a guy give a demo, and I really wish I could remember who this was. I remember it happening at the demo. This was many years ago. And the guy made so much sense, and I believe he actually pissed off about half the people in the room when he did what he did, but I thought what he did was genius. Now, he made a dirt hole set, and he put a little rock about the size of, I don't know, a quarter, you know, just a rock, next to his trap. And he goes, now a lot of people will tell you on blocking that you set this right here because the animal will step next to it and be right where you want him to be. Then he picks up the rock and he throws it like 10 foot away. He goes, or you can throw it over there and that cow will step right next to that rock. Then he went over and he picked it up again and kind of slung it across the demo area. And he goes, well, if he sees the rock way over there, he's going to run over there and step next to the rock. And, you know, the guys that got what he was doing kind of laughed, and the guys that did the rock thing, they got mad, you know, and it was just he was just making a joke, basically. But the premise of what he was doing was people put faith in little things that they think makes a big difference. And a lot of time, if you look at it from a very logical, critical thinking point of way, guys, it really doesn't. It can make the trapper feel better, but it's not going to make any difference with the animal that's out there. Now, using little rocks or pebbles around your trap may or may not work for you. I don't know. I don't like them. I'll tell you that. Now, the reason I don't like using rocks, if they're bigger rocks, animals will step on them. Yes, they will. No question whatsoever. They will step on them. And if you're using it to guide their feet and it's big enough for them to step on, you're kind of cutting your own throat there. So that's not very smart. The other thing that happens with the little bitty rocks is it's a rock. And if a rock gets moved from a deer coming up and checking your set, or the animal's kind of digging around or whatever, rolls and it moves it out of the way, and now it's in the scissors or your jaws, now your trap's going to malfunction. So to me, the using the rocks that way, and I've done it in the past, and I've also paid the price for it in the past, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And what I want to do is I want to go through some of the more common animals about blocking and kind of the theories behind it and why I do what I do when I'm out trapping, and you can take it or leave it, or you can play with it a little bit, or you can do whatever. But as simple as this type of topic is, if you don't know about it, or you've never seen someone that's really good at blocking before, where it looks natural, which is a big key for the most part, you may learn something here. So that's the point of having trapping radio. So we're going to do that. Now, so I want to start with coyotes. Now, what I want you to do, guys, is hit pause on the podcast and go grab a trap. This will make this easier because this is not a video. This is audio. And or I want you to get a piece of paper and I want you to draw a coil spring or a long spring or whatever. And I want you to put a little hole in, you know, out in front of it like it's a dirt hole. Just draw a set. You know, what your set is right now is completely irrelevant. It can be a dirt hole. It can be a flat set. It can be a combination of the two. It can be fancy or basic. I don't care. But we want to talk about the basics of blocking on different animals because they are different. So we're going to start with coyotes. Now, there's a couple of ways that I block coyotes that seem to work very, very well for me. Now, the first one is what we're going to call the two-stick method. Two sticks. You'll notice I say sticks, not rocks. But what I'm looking for with a coyote-type blocking is something that's about the size, a little bit smaller than a pencil. That's about the size I'm looking for. And I'm also looking for it where it's going to stick out of the ground about 4 inches. Three's fine, five's fine, but somewhere around in there. So, you know, you can cut these on site, you can take them with it, whatever you want to do, and your system is totally fine. So we got these little sticks that aren't really big, but they're not really small, so a coyote just can't, you know, step on it and break it, and he don't even know he's done anything. But it is big enough to be a deterrent to step on. Now, with your drawing of your trap, which I hope you did, so this makes more sense, and we're going to say, I want you to have a hole for the dirt hole, and I want you to bring your trap out in front of it or to the side, wherever it is that you want to have, however you think that animal is going to approach that set. And this is basically the way that I've pretty much learned when I was taking instruction from O'Gorman, from watching him do his guiding on coyotes. The two-stick and the three-stick method is what I learned from him, and I want to explain this to you. So you've got your trap in front of your set, whatever that is. Now, however you want to have your jaws, we're not going to get into, really don't care at the time. So we're going to have our trap sitting there. Now, when you have your trap set, and before you do your final sifting, and you know where everything is at on that, let's say that if it's a dirt hole and you're going to have them go between the jaws, you want to do that. Well, on both sides up towards the front, but still on the jaws, like on the corner of the jaws in there, I'm going to put two sticks that are barely leaning out, but are still somewhat straight up in the ground. Because nothing's going to step down on a straight sticking up stick. Because, you know, the Vietnamese used it, and it was called punji sticks, and it would go through jungle boots. Now, animals that live in the wild, they know not to step on sticks that are sticking up, just as you would if you wouldn't go out and try to stomp on something that was sticking straight up. So this two-stick method for coyotes, if you're breaking off a fresh stick and it's got that, you know, real clean look from live wood, just put it, you know, smeared around in the dirt a little bit to knock that freshness off. Put them on both sides of the jaws. Now, you want to put this on their approach, how you think they're going to approach the set. And what it does is it lines up one of the other feet when they're coming up to the set most of the time. And it's pretty effective. You know, and it doesn't come across as being crazy unnatural, which is what you don't want with a phobic animal like a coyote. Now, the other way we do this is with three sticks, and you're going to have the sticks on the side of your jaws where they're touching your jaws, guys, touching your jaws. Now, if you're using a little bitty trap like a 550 or something, you may want to take them out where they're, you know, a half inch, three quarter inch from the jaws. But on a number three, you know, a coyote style set, you're going to have those. They're going to be touching on the bigger traps. And then when you do the three stick, all it is you're giving him a shortstop with a stick in front. Now, if your levers are going into your hole where he's going between your jaws, you'll have to kind of do that on an angle, and basically you're just going to put it up like on a 45 degree angle or something where it stops going over those levers but can't get caught in the lever. So it needs to be high enough when the trap goes off that it's not getting pinched between the lever and the jaws, because I could lock the trap up. And what that does is it'll guide one of his 2 feet, because he's not going to step on the sticks. And animals have a tendency, when there is a shortstop of some kind, and it can be drastically changing dirt color, it can be anything like that. When you give them something like that, a lot of times they will stutter step right in front of it. And it's not a natural looking. Those 3 sticks, it'll be unnatural to you if you've never done it. But if you look out in the woods where a groundhog, you know, digs something up or something like that, that there's sticks where they've been digging through them. So it's no big deal. Now, the other thing that I do when it comes to coyotes, if I feel there's any need to block it and I can't pick the best location where the animal's, his approach is going to be really, really narrowed down, is I like using droppings. I pick them up all the time. I don't care if it's a house dog or a coyote or a bobcat or anything else. You know, I mean, stuff like deer and stuff would be a little hard. You can use cow droppings, but let me warn you a little bit about that. Under those cow droppings, every skunk in the country knows that there's usually some grubs down there, and they come over and start screwing with your set. Maybe not because of what you've done, but because you put cow droppings. So if you're going to use something like that or a real crusty horse turd, just keep that in mind, but it will work. Animals, like coyotes and stuff, do not like stepping on droppings. You hardly ever see one stepped on in the wild from anything except people. And so that's why they're good blocking. Now, a lot of times what I will do with the dropping or two is I will fill in an area around that trap that is, I think, is exposed from them not putting their feet where I want them. So it may not be right up against the jaws, or it may not be right in front of the trap. It may be one, you know, leaning off at an angle, and another one just taking up space where it's going to put them more where I want them to be. And as you're starting to see from this, you're still leaving these sets for coyotes very wide open, guys. All you're trying to do is just give yourself a little bit of an edge. That's all you can hope for. If you start trying to cat trap them, your catch is going to go way down because the blocking is way too much. Now, there's 2 things that I love to use on coyotes. And depending on where you are or where you can find them or something like that, you may or may not be able to use these too. Now, I grow chestnuts, and if you've never seen a chestnut hole, it is a medieval weapon. It really is. It'll go through flip-flops. I've got where the ducks have got into them things before, and they got holes in their feet, and I mean, they think something bit them. What it is, it's like the nut comes in there in the middle of this like cocoon, and it's got porcupine spikes going every which direction. And they're very, very sharp. Now, the neat thing about the chestnuts, when they come apart on the ground, most of the time they're in halves, or it's really easy to make them a half because they're hollow. And you can take with gloves carefully, because they will go through leather gloves if you do this too hard. But you can break them, and now you got 2 halves. So you got a flat side that's hollow, and you've got this, you know, medieval looking spiked up thing on top. And they're about, you know, good size chestnut holes, going to probably be 2.5 inches across. Now, what I'll do, since I have the chestnut trees, is if I'm going out to set coyotes, I'll go up there and get a small bucket or something like that, and I'll scoop a bunch of them things up. And then when I go out, I'll break them in half. And I'll put 2 or 3 that are just haphazard and doesn't mean anything to a hill of beans, just so if a coyote's never seen or smelled that, they're you know, a couple of feet away, they're in a very haphazard pattern where it's not going to be just crazy for them to see it if they've never seen it. And then I'm going to use those chestnuts just like I did the 2 or 3 sticks. So I've got the hollow point, and before I do my final sift, I know where my jaws and levers are. I'm going to put that chestnut and snug that thing down pretty well into the ground, just so wind or something lightly touching it's going to blow it off. You still run a small risk of something knocking that over. But animals, when they see these spikes, they know not to step on them. Down in Texas, I use cactus. I will transplant cactus. No coyote is going to on purpose step in cactus unless they're hunting or chasing or scared from something. But unless you live in Texas country, which most of us don't, you don't have that option. But chestnuts, and if you can figure out what the tree looks like, start driving around, usually late spring, and you'll see these trees that have these flower things on there, and they smell kind of, I think they smell kind of good because I know what they are. Cindy hates the smell of them because they're kind of rude smelling. And you can smell them things a couple hundred yards away when those flowers are on and they're pollinating. So once you learn what they are, no one is ever going to stop you from getting the chestnut holes out of their yard if they got a chestnut. Because kids, dogs, everything else, they can cause an issue. So getting them's not hard if you can find them. You know, and if you're going to be in this a long way, plant some chestnut trees for goodness sake, and you've got your own blocking for life that a coyote will never, ever step on. Now you can take that to the bank. And coyotes is one of those things I never say ever. They do not step on chestnuts. The other one that does not work as well, but it's more common, is the sweet gums. They drop their balls and they're somewhat spiky, but not like a chestnut. And a certain variety of those have more spikes. And when you find them, just put them in a bucket, keep them out of the weather, and they will just stay there for a couple of years before they fall apart. And then you can go out and place these sweet gums around your trap where you would put sticks or droppings or, you know, something like that. And you want to do it where it looks haphazard to the animal, where it's not left, right, you know, dress like military or the way people think. But it's kind of scattered around. They're cheap, so you don't have to be, or they're free. I mean, really. So it's not like you got to be stingy with these things. But those are my favorite ways of blocking up a coyote. You know, and to be honest with you, the chestnuts to me are the best. Absolutely, hands down, the best. But the sticks will work. The droppings will work. Sometimes the droppings give you a little bit of extra smell component at the set, you know. So I mean, that's definitely has some advantage. Now we're going to break over to the bobcats, guys. Totally different. Scratch everything I just said, and we're going to go and we're going to talk about bobcats. Now, if you can go watch how I do this on YouTube for free, or you can get the Cat Collector video or the whole video, all my videos on howtotrapit.com, and you can see Cat Collector, the full 4 hours of me showing how I catch so many cats. But you can also get glimpses of it on YouTube, and that's free. But what I want you to do now, if you've got a trap in front of you and it's set, or draw the type of trap that you have that you use on a piece of paper. Now we're going to get a little bit different with the blocking of a cat. Now, when you look at the old books and the stuff in the old magazines, a lot of people use these golf ball size rocks, baseball size rocks. They lay down logs and bees. They do all kind of stuff. I'm here to tell you, you're asking for trouble. Asking for real trouble. If you don't believe me, guys, put trail cameras on some of your sets that you do that with. And when you're done crying, you'll never do it again, because I know what's going to happen, and you'll see it for your own two eyes. So with bobcats, you got your trap in front of you, you got it drawn. If we're going to have it where the cat's going between the jaws up to a dirt hole or in a cubby or whatever it is you're doing, that set, we're not getting into trap distance or anything else. We're just talking about blocking up a set. You want to have three sticks that are about the size of a pencil broke off where they're touching the right hand side of the jaws. You want to have that where they're touching. Now, if you're using a smaller trap for cats, and when I'm in Texas and I'm using the CDRs, that's a 7.5 inch jaw spread, and then I'll have sticks touching the other jaws. But if I'm in Tennessee or somewhere else and I'm not using a big trap like that, I'm using a No. 3 Bridger Douglas or whatever, on the right-hand side, because that's where most cats will go for whatever reason, and I've done lots and lots of research and notes on this. If you're looking at the trap in front of you, like you're sitting at a desk and your attractor is further in front of you, the right-hand side is what I'm talking about. You want those three sticks touching the jaw up against the jaw. So those go in before you do your final sifting. And then you want to give a cat about 7, 7.5 inches, which is fine for a 60-pound cat or a 2-pound cat. Didn't make any difference. You want to give them that 7 inches. So you're on 7 inches to the left of that, to 7.5 inches. I wouldn't go over 8, but I will want 3 sticks again. So these are very uniform in the way that they're going. Now we're going to get into something that's a little more technical about this. I use big pans, and if you're not using big pans, I don't understand it. But if you're determined to use a small pan that's going to allow you to miss fur, you're going to have to adjust for that. Now, you can build them, big pans. I don't sell them. You can get them from Expanda Pans, where they're so simple to put on. It's like putting just a new pan on a trap. It's real simple. You can get those from Chip. Whatever you're going to use for big pans, shingles, I don't care. It just needs to be bigger. And this is one time where bigger actually is better. So you got your big pan, and their sticks are straight up and down. If you're going to use a baby pan, and you're going to still try to catch cats with it, and you're going to try to catch them consistently, what I do with those sticks, when those pans are coming out really close to the jaw, you know, like finger width or whatever away from that jaw, and I got those sticks straight up and down, if a cat steps up against those sticks, and that's where he's going to step, guys, it's going to be where his fur's touching that line. He's going to hit my pan, and you catch him. Now, if you're using the small pan where you've got all that empty space around there and you put your sticks on the jaws and you're sitting there with, you know, an inch and a half between them, a cat very easily, and I've seen it done so many times before I went to the big pans, they will go up against that right-hand side where those sticks are because they're pretty close. You're giving him a wall like a mink set. His fur will touch those sticks. He'll be so close. And a lot of times he will completely miss your pan. And that's a bad day for the trapper. So if you're going to use the baby pans, then you're going to have to figure out a way to either get sticks that are curved or longer ones where you can go over the jaw but high enough and they're thin enough that a cat's not going to try to step on it. So you move your line of sticks on the edge of your pan, not the jaws, because where the cat steps is going to be where you tell him to step. And if you use the baby pans, you're going to miss cats. So sometimes when I use stock traps, I will get sticks and I will put them in at an angle from the side, or I'll get a longer, stronger stick and I will sit there and push it in on an angle, either front or back, where it's coming up over the jaws, but where it's not going to get caught in the jaws. You don't want it just a quarter inch off the ground or something. You got to give your jaws ways to come up. So that's what we're going to be doing with that. And then on the outsides of that little wall and going up to your set, it needs to be a mess. And what I mean by a mess is like a bramble, where it looks like a bunch of, you know, trees have been cut down in the past, or limbs, or primrose that you slashed with a machete or something, or pruners, and you're sticking those all over the ground where it's a mess. There's no uniformity. There's no way to step in between it, and nothing wants to go there. And then you give him the cleanliness of this little 7.5-inch chute with these perfectly two walls. He's going to go the right-hand side, and if you've got the right pan or adjusted for your small pan, you're going to catch the cat. You know, that's very important for you, for a cat trapper to get. An exposed cat trap to me is about like trying to block up a cow. You can catch some sometimes, but you're going to miss a whole lot more. And on the blocking on cats, it's very important. Because a lot of times they don't do the work the set the same way that canines do. They're just kind of curious, and once their curiosity is filled, it's over with. And that's a one-time shot, really, for a cat. Cats don't come back and check out the sets afterwards. You're going to have to move it or change it if you miss the cat. You know, if you see that you have a miss, that's what you're going to have to do. Now we're going to go to fox. Now, my experience with fox, with being guys that catch a lot of fox, the blocking on fox is nothing. Zero, nothing. That's what the blocking is. So you don't want to really do anything. I guess you could if you just wanted to. I mean, you could really narrow them down with chestnuts or sweet gums or something like that. I don't think they're going to be afraid of much. Red Fox guys, if you're still in the belief that Red Fox are difficult to catch, you hadn't caught enough yet to figure that out, that they're not. If you can catch a skunk, you can catch a fox. If you can catch a coon, you can catch a fox. The big thing nowadays is, do you have fox to catch? And a lot of places, here included, the Red Fox seem to be making a comeback. I don't know if it took them like 15 years to figure out how to deal with the coyotes or what, but they're starting to show up a little bit, and I'm hearing that from a lot of different trappers around the country and different outdoorsmen and stuff like that. So I don't really see any reason to block down a fox. They're very hyper-footed anyway, and you know, you get them on the right approach, they're caught. So no big deal there. Now, gray fox is a very different story. And if you've ever heard Glenn Beck, and when he talks about President Wilson or what's the big liberal guy that funds everything, Soros, and he always goes, "And I hate that guy." It's kind of like a joke that he does. Well, when it comes to gray fox, I'm kind of like that with gray fox. Them little peckerheads, to me, without having a big population of them, drive me insane. And I'll be honest with you, they drive me crazy. But I finally have figured out where they don't drive me crazy enough, and that's how I block them. Now, a gray fox is like a cat. Now, with them, it doesn't seem like they're so right side orientated like a bobcat is, for whatever reason. But they're very much like a cat or a great big mink in the way that they work sets. So if you got an open set, it's just, you know, a whistle and a prayer, and hopefully he steps where you want him to step. But now what I want you to do is I want you to draw on your paper, visualize this with me. You've got a dirt hole, and you've got it mounded up with some dirt or rocks or whatever to make sure you can't come in from the backside, because they will. And then I want you to take a ridge on the left or right-hand side and kind of come out a little bit on an angle with that ridge. And that ridge could probably only be about 12 inches long, 3-4 inches high. And it just needs to be dirt or scraped up, whatever, pine needles or whatever you've got in your area. But you need to have that little bit of ridge right there. And that ridge, because they act like a cat and a mink, they like when they're going up against something that they're not quite sure about. They're not afraid of anything like a coyote is, but they are cautious. I mean, they got a lot of bravery, but they're still one of the smallest things out there. And what the gray fox have done when I started playing around with this, when you have that ridge that comes out, so you've got your hole, let's say you scrape up a bunch of dirt from the backside, and then you just run a ridge out to one side, just where it's 2 or 3 inches up, and it's loose, soft dirt. And then I will bed that trap right up tight next to the ridge, whatever side that's on. And then I will put the sticks on the side of the jaw, just like the bobcats. And if you use the baby pans, you're going to have to adjust, because a gray fox foot is so small. When he goes up against the edge that you give him, which he will do most of the time, his foot can step there all day long and never even be close to a standard pan. So he's inside your jaws, but you're not going to catch him. And if you've done a lot of gray fox trapping, you know exactly what I'm talking about, because they can aggravate you to death. But this is somewhat of an equalizer. So you're using their habits with the ridge, and you're using the sticks to give them a more up and down ridge, and they're not going to step on those sticks. And they seem to like hugging that little bit of ridge that you put out there, and then you have a lot better luck. So, you know, that's what I do with gray fox. Now, with coon are not something you have to be very worried about doing anything that's really going to get them upset or nervous or anything. That's a coon. Now, I do, when I'm doing water sets, I do I do the same thing on beaver. And what I want you to do is I want you to draw just a crude thing on your trapper, if you've got one sitting in front of you. And then I want you to put your stick straight up and down on the outside of those jaws. And then I want you to bring them over to about a 45 degree angle. And what I like to find are sticks that already have a curvature to them. And if you bring them in on that angle where they're right up next to your jaws, it gives the impression in water that they have more room than they really have. And because you're kind of doing it like the backside of a gun sight, it seems to line them up. So if I'm in the water, I've got these 45 degree sticks that are coming to the sides of the trap. You know, and the way I usually set traps are a little deeper than I know a lot of y'all do, but it works the same. So when the coon is coming up, however I think they're going to hug the bank, they're going to be out in the shallow creek or whatever, I'm going to have these sticks where they're on 45 degree angles coming off. And if you once you do that out in the woods, you'll see it actually looks pretty natural, and it lines stuff up for you. Now, I do that on beaver and I do that on the coon. If I'm doing a dry land coon and I want to block them at a set, I'll block them more like a bobcat. To be honest with you, I just want to get them in a shoot where they get caught and get it over with. I won't be as crazy about it probably as I will, or as anal about it as I will for a bobcat, but that's kind of the way that I do it. If it's a trail set, I do the X thing that I've learned from Bob Best. And the X is exactly what it sounds like. You've got a trail and you just run a stick in one direction, so it's on one side of the trail, then goes across the trail to the other side of the trail, but it's sticking at an angle, so it's coming up. Then you just stick another one opposite from that and you make a cross across the trail, and the coon will come up, and it doesn't matter what size your trap on, it's the right side, and when he goes to step over, his foot will be right in front of that and you'll catch him. Or if your trap's on the other side, when he comes down across that, because you want the bottom of your X to be, you know, 3, 4, or 5 inches off of the ground where the X meets. And you want it to be sturdy so they just don't blow it over. But when he steps over, either way, he's in your trap. You know, that works fairly well on cats when you're talking about trails. You can do a smaller version of that, and it works pretty good on grays. I've caught coyotes in those, but to me it's a little unnatural, so I don't like doing that. Even though I have caught some, I still don't think that's the best. So that's what I do with coon. Now, beaver, we're going to do the 45 degree angle thing again on the. So if you're running a foothold trap at a cast around set or whatever, I want to have a stick coming on both sides that for when that beaver's in the water, we're not going to go into all the current and all the variables of that, but however you think the beaver's going to go up into that, you want to have the sticks on a 45. It lines them up, it puts them right where you want them to be, and it doesn't look crazy and natural, because beaver, believe it or not, will pick up on unnatural, especially if they've been screwed with. You know, the other thing I like doing with beaver is the bramble thing, like the cats. So if you've ever been or seen me trapping beaver, otter, I always have pruning shears with me. Or I've got a really good quality Swedish small axe that's you can almost shave with. So what I do with that is when I'm putting in the set and you've got this some old wood or whatever's laying around there, I can hit it with the pruner or I can hit it with the axe, and I can just move it in where it's half on the bank and half in the water or whatever. But it gives the animal a clear line of travel with all this other mess and jumbled stuff going off to the sides, and it doesn't look unnatural. What you don't want to do with beaver, guys, and I see it all the time on YouTube, is to have a foothold in the ground or a body grip in the ground, and you just start sticking these sticks straight up in the air like you see in the old 1800 trapping books. Now, that'll work for a beaver that's never been around purse people and has never been trapped. You start doing that around beaver that gets some pressure, they're not going to mess with that. They know that there's some danger there. Now, they may not understand that there's a trapper that wouldn't set a trap and all that, but they will start recognizing what I call building a trapper's fort, which is just line of these sticks going out through there. Just go and make it look more natural. Cut some old dead limbs or whatever. Move them into the sides. You can trim them up so you got them the perfect little place there to go up. It looks natural. Another trapper is not going to see it from 100 yards off because it just looks like something fell in the water. And you can become somewhat of an artist with doing that. And the beaver and otter, which is I do the same with them if I'm doing water sets and footholds, is the same with the brambles. So that's what I do with the beaver. Now, otter, like I said, it's the same with a beaver, unless it's going to what I'm starting to do a lot more of, where I'm finding shallows in creeks and I'm blind setting them with two traps, foothold traps now, not body grips, but foothold traps. And what I like to do then is I will get something that's about half inch thick, 3/4 inch thick, something like that, needs to be stout. An old beaver stick works perfect. And where I can see that they're going to have to start walking in the creek again are shallows with rocks or anything else like that. I put the traps, and I have them where they're about 4 inches apart, and I'll put that stick where the stick is above water just a couple of inches. And if you've ever seen otter go down a creek, they lope. So what they'll do is they'll adjust the lope before they get to your stick and you catch them. And if you miss them on that, when they go over the stick, you're gonna catch them. So it's a pretty basic thing of doing, but it needs to be something that's really solid, and it's something that the current's not gonna take away or something like that. And that's the only other thing that I do with otter when it comes to this, is that type of just one side of the X type thing, but it's more close to parallel to the top of the water. And that is a deadly otter set. I mean, if you've got creeks that are coming in and out of ponds and everything like that, and you got shallows in there where it's inconvenient because your body grip stands out like a sore thumb, and if you've got pressure on your otter, they're not going to be playing that game anyway. You put those footholds in, and I mean, you've got big burn circles going everywhere. Now, I personally use drags, the big saber tooths on them, because I can pre-hook, and if I can't pre-hook that around a tree, I just take I always have, you know, 6 or 7, I don't carry a lot, of just rebar that I can run down through the drag where the chain hooks up, and it's staked if it needs to be. So that's kind of the system. And when I'm doing it, I'm using it mostly with my CDRs. But number threes work, fours work, long springs work. It doesn't make any difference. So that's the otter side of this. Now for blind sets, I almost always use droppings. And it's for the going back to the reason animals don't like stepping on droppings. Plus, there's a little bit of natural smell there. I don't use lure, don't use bait, anything like that. So I'm going to have that. If I'm using two traps, they're in between the two traps. And if you're using coil springs, what you want to do is you bed them in where the levers have maybe a 16th between them. That's how close you want the levers on a number three. You put a small stick in there that's sticking straight up in the air. You blend them in, you bed them in. Your little stick is still above ground level. You can see it. You get a dropping, you pick that up, and you replace exactly where that was with the dropping. And no matter which way the animal's coming down, he's going to step on it while he's smelling, or stepping on it as he's going over, or he's going to step on it when he goes to the other side. I mean, it's just crazy deadly how that works. Now, if you've got, just go back to the couch a little bit because this ran into my mind. So let's say that you've got a two track or a logging road or something like that, and there's a game trail that's sitting right off next to, going like perpendicular away from the trail. So you say your trail's going north and south, and you've got a trail going to the east. And it's pretty predominant, and you could go in and put a dirt hole 2 feet up that trail and blow it up. I mean, have dirt hanging off of trees and all. I mean, just make it look like a disaster happened right then. You could even do this 10 feet up the trail. It's not going to make any difference, especially if the wind's blowing from your set to the road. And then going into that little trail, put a blind set. And it doesn't even have to be close to the set. You just got it in the trail, and you use the dropping in between, caught coyote. And then when I make it sound like that's too easy, it's because it really is that easy. You know, because you're using the habits of the animals against them instead of trying to force what you want to force on them. So I was going to say that about the droppings. Now, what you need to always look out for when it comes to using blocking. You don't use rocks, which went over, and I want to cover that again. Bigger rocks, grays, coons, everything will step on them because they step on them all day long. You know, everybody thinks if you have a high spot, they won't step on it. Hogwash. If you got a low spot, they're going to step there. Hogwash. You know, if you've got rocks, they won't step on there because that's blocking. The animal doesn't know it's blocking, so he ain't afraid to step on it. He didn't know the rules of the game. If he did, he'd definitely be stepping on top of every rock he'd get a hold of. Now, the other thing, if you're using the small rocks, is remember they have a tendency to get moved around with when you have possums coming up and you got paying attention, you're not catching the possums as much. A lot of that stuff gets rolled around and it can get kind of squirrely. And see, when I'm talking about the chestnuts and the sweet gums, animals don't like to rub up and mess with things that can hurt them, and a chestnut will hurt them. So that's one thing. Flat sticks. I know all of the old cat books show this. I know they do. Or they'll have you go and put your set up next to a log that's, you know, 12 inches or whatever. And you're smearing your bait and lure around and this, that, and the other, and you got your logs on the side, you know, so they can only go in one way. It could be straight in or a B or however it is you want to do it. And if you put a trail cam on that, you're going to watch cat and gray fox, one after the other, walk up that, because you've given them the high ground to check out your set. You're giving them the high ground. You're telling them that's the best place to go because you got a better view up here. Guys, come on up. That's what you're doing. So if you're using 6-inch, you know, dead logs on next to your traps, you're giving them the place they want to go. Now, see, when I'm using those little broken off sticks, they don't want to step on that because I'm not telling them that it's a good place to go. If you put it up against a log, especially with gray fox, a lot of times the gray fox will get up on the log and lay on that dang thing and steal your bait. He'll lay on it like a big old football player after a frat party that's had too much beer. He'll just lay on it with his gut on the thing, and he will check out what you got going on. Not the best way to go. So big sticks, big logs, don't really like it. If you want to use a log, find one that's hollow and put your set at the front of it. You know, that'll work. Now, before we close, guys, I want to talk a little bit about snares. Blocking snares needs to be natural. Now, if I know that I'm going to be in a place that is really more wide open, I most of the time am going to have my little axe with me. And keep in mind, this is not a Walmart axe. You can find them sometimes at trapping conventions. You can order them online. If you're going to get a good axe to do what I'm talking about, you're going to drop $100 to $200. I'm just fair warning before you go look. If you're going to be at the Nationals, Clay Mace, which now makes the Grizzle Getter, makes a very good tomahawk that will work for this. But it needs to be good metal and it needs to be sharp. And what I like doing on more open ground is I will find small trees, like around here we have a lot of privet. North Carolina has a lot of laurel. What I'm normally trying to look for is, when I'm coming up to a place, is I'm looking around for something that's evergreen at the time. And I can take that axe with one swipe and I've got a very sharp point. And then I can use a re-rod and kind of dig out a hole, and I can plant that bush in that hole and pack it down. And I can have a 2 or 3 foot high, thick evergreen bush. And being in the winter and the ground's normally wet, you'll get about 10 days before it starts looking really, really bad. See, now I can move that right up to where I'm going to put the snare, and I can take my side cutters, you know, my little pruners, like you'd see a gardener use, and I can snip out everything that can touch that snare, and I've totally got that coyote blocked down, but it doesn't look unnatural. The other way to do that is to cut a tree or some branches and have them going at different angles where the bushier part comes up to where the snare is, but it looks like they just fell on the ground. We're not making a straight wall. Not making a straight wall. You want them to be cockeyed and everything else, so it looks somewhat natural for that to happen. So that's what I do with snares. The other thing that I do with snares, if there's no vegetation or vegetation would look out of place, is I try to get big clumps of grass. Like we have around here, a lot of buffalo grass, you know, just clumping grass that's got a, you know, a couple of feet on them. And you can dig those up down at the roots, and you can go over where, right next to where your snare is going to be, dig you out a divot, plant that thing back in there, smooth it all back up so it doesn't look like it has been planted there. And you can use grass to block down your snares. Now, that'll work on everything. But there's some extra precautions you have to take with cats. And since we're talking about blocking down, I'm going to finish up with this. With bobcats, they're not allowed to have any whisker room around that snare. That means your blocking needs to be within a half an inch of that snare, but never touch it. That's one of the major rules of snare. Nothing's ever allowed to touch your cable. So you got to have it right up to the sides. That takes away the whisker room. Because a cat, they're very visual, they're very slow moving, and they pay a lot of attention in a trail. And a snare is not the most natural thing. If you give them 2 or 3 inches, he'll put his nose on the outside of that snare and just shoulder walk around your snare. Not a good deal. The other thing a cat will do when he sees a snare is he's going to lower himself down. You can see house cats do that when they see something that's strange. They lower their self down. Now, once they lower their self down and you got your snare, you know, 8, 10, 12, whatever size cat you have off the ground, now he's going to see he can go under the snare, and he will. So you need to block the bottom of the snare. And I like putting 4 or 5 sticks at different angles where he can see, and they need to be within 1/2 inch of the bottom of the cable, that's not a way for him to go. And another thing a cat will do is he'll just flat jump over it if you give him a chance. So you've got to block the top. Cats are a little different than any other animal you're going to deal with. So you got to have some type of structure where it's going to be, you know, where it's almost touching your snare about 1/2 inch, then maybe a couple other loose branches coming up. And then it gives him the only illusion going down the trail is going through this opening. And they're used to going through openings. But if you give them an option not to go through the opening, because they're going to see it's a snare, guys. They're not going to, don't believe that horse crap about they think it's a vine. They know it's not supposed to be there. There's nothing natural about a snare, no matter how you paint it or whatever you do. Animals know it's there. They just make the choice because they don't realize that it can catch them to go through there. But if they have the option, they're going to go around it or under it or with a cat over it. So keep all those things in mind with your blocking. Now see, blocking, we've talked about it now for what, 40 minutes? I hope this helps you when you go out, because it is a simple thing, but sometimes each individual animal you go after needs to be a little bit different. And if you're thinking that you just think back to when I was telling you that story in that demo where someone puts a little bitty pebble down next to a jaw and thinks it's going to force him to step somewhere else. That's ridiculous, because it just doesn't work that way, because that means a cow would just go from little pebble to little pebble, stepping right up next to it, and that's not the way it works in the real world. Just because you're making the set with that intention doesn't make it so. So keep all this stuff in mind, guys, when you're going out. And hopefully this will help you put some more fur in the truck. Because with the fur prices, it seems like they're getting back up there. You don't want to be looking at empty traps because you just didn't do the best thing that you could do at the time. So this is Clint, and I will talk to y'all next week.
Rise and shine. 6 a.m. and your hand can't make it to the alarm clock before the voices in your head start telling you that it's too early, too dark, and too cold to get out of bed. Aching muscles lie still in rebellion, pretending not to hear your brain commanding them to move. A legion of voices are shouting their unanimous permission for you to hit the snooze button and go back to dreamland. But you didn't ask their opinion. The voice you've chosen to listen to is one of defiance. A voice that says there was a reason you set that alarm in the first place. So sit up, put your feet on the floor, and don't look back, because we've got work to do. Welcome to the grind. For what is each day but a series of conflicts between the right way and the easy way? 10,000 streams fan out like a river delta before you, each one promising the path of least resistance. Thing is, you're headed upstream. And when you make that choice, when you decide to turn your back on what's comfortable and safe and what some would call common sense, well, that's day one. From there, it only gets tougher. So just make sure this is something you want, because the easy way out will always be there, ready to wash you away. All you have to do is pick up your feet. But you aren't going to, are you? With each step comes the decision to take another. You're on your way now, but this is no time to dwell on how far you've come. You're in a fight against an opponent you can't see, but oh, you can feel him on your heels, can't you? Feel him breathing down your neck. You know what that is? That's you. Your fears, your doubts, and insecurities all lined up like a firing squad, ready to shoot you out of the sky. But don't lose heart. While they're not easily defeated, they are far from invincible. Remember, this is the grind. The battle royale between you and your mind, your body, and the devil on your shoulder is telling you that this is just a game. This is just a waste of time. Your opponents are stronger than you. Drown out the voice of uncertainty with the sound of your own heartbeat. Burn away your self-doubt with a fire lit beneath you. Remember what we're fighting for and never forget that momentum is a cruel mistress. She can turn on a dime or the smallest mistake. She is ever searching for the weak place in your armor, that one tiny thing you forgot to prepare for. So as long as the devil is hiding the details, the question remains, is that all you got? Are you sure? And when the answer is yes, when you've done all you can to prepare yourself for battle, then it's time to go forth and boldly face your enemy, the enemy within. Only now you must take that fight into the open, into hostile territory. You're a lion in a field of lions, all hunting the same elusive prey with a desperate starvation that says victory is the only thing that can keep you alive. So believe that voice that says you can run a little faster and you can throw a little harder, and that for you, the laws of physics are merely a suggestion. Luck is the last dying wish of those who want to believe that winning can happen by accident. Sweat, on the other hand, is for those who know it's a choice. So decide now, because destiny waits for no man. And when your time comes and 1,000 different voices are trying to tell you you're not ready for it, listen instead to that lone voice of dissent. The one that says you are ready. You are prepared. It's all up to you now. So rise and shine.